From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present a previously recorded episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank's guest is Ann Kennedy, a contributing writer of the Christian Research Journal. Now, here is Hank Hanegraaff.
Welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast. It is our mission to bring the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people to your earbuds. And I'm excited today to introduce Ann Kennedy. She's no stranger to those who read the Christian Research Journal, our flagship magazine. She's written for us many times, probably 12 to 15 articles, somewhere in that range. And she grew up in Mali, West Africa. And she came to America to go to college. She earned a BA from Cornell University in French and English literature. And then she graduated from Virginia Theological Seminary with an MDiv. Ann is married to Matt, who is also a contributor to the Christian Research Journal. Matt serves as rector of the Church of the Good Shepherd, an Anglican church in New York. Ann and Matt have six children. So you can imagine the kind of schedule that Ann keeps. She oversees liturgy, music, and catechesis for the church. She does a blog that is called Preventing Grace. And she's the author of a book titled Nailed It, 365 Readings for Angry and Worn Out People. And as I mentioned, she is prolific in many ways. She writes on many different topics, and I am just delighted, Ann, to have you on the Hank Unplugged podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm totally amazed to be getting to talk to you. Matt and I have been such huge fans of your ministry over the years, and we still can't believe that we occasionally write for your journal, which has really helped us through our ministry and kept us sane in all of the ups and downs.
Yeah. Talk about your ups and downs in transitioning from the Episcopal Church to the Anglican Church.
Well, it's been a while, so I've tried not to think about it too much over the years, but it has been interesting to watch the rest of the American Christian world kind of pitch into a similar kind of division that we endured. I guess it's been quite a long time now. My husband was ordained in 2002, and the Episcopal Church kind of, I use the word, pitched into apostasy in 2003 by electing a bishop who was in a relationship with another man. And our church began a long process of discernment about what we would do at that time, and formally left the denomination in 2007. At that point, the American Church in North America had begun to form, and so we were rescued by the Anglican Church of Kenya, and eventually, you know, were reincorporated back into the American Church. And I would say that actually looking back on it, it was a pretty exciting time, of course, because week by week we didn't always know if we were going to have a job or what was going to happen, if the church was going to grow and thrive in this tumultuous time or if it would crumble and fall. And so we were always desperate and being thrown back on God's mercy. And looking back, it's interesting to see how much God took care of us and how gracious he was to us and how really we were never really in peril. He took us along the way. So times of ease in some sense are more difficult for the life of a church than a time of difficulty and even persecution.
One of the interesting parts of this transition is that the Roman Catholic Church actually reached out and gave you a church to use, and the church that you were formerly worshiping in was actually sold to Muslims.
Yes, the providence of God in the middle of it was really astonishing to us. A church, we had been part of an ecumenical council with, in our very small area, there were about seven different churches, and we had shared a VBS program and a Thanksgiving service every year and had a really good relationship with the churches here around us. And so when we lost our lawsuit in January of 2009, then Monsignor Mahar saw in the paper that we had lost and called us. We were packing our house without any idea of where we were going to go. So he offered, he had just moved out of the rectory over here at what was St. Andrew's, and he told us just to move in and then to use the sanctuary here rent-free, and then they lowered the price enough that we would easily be able to buy it from them. It was it's a nice big property with enough parking, which is a big deal now. And, of course, at the same time, the Episcopal Church had adopted what many called a scorched earth policy, which they would not sell back to congregations that had left. And so they chose instead to lower the price there. They sold it for, I think it was about a quarter of what we had offered for it to the Muslim community that is still there.
You probably know a lot about Islam. You grew up in Mali as a missionary's kid, as I understand it.
Yes, I spent my whole childhood in Mali. I went to a boarding school, a Conservative Baptist boarding school in Ivory Coast. And yes, our village was mostly animist. I think that's the word that most people still use, the indigenous religion. But Islam was definitely growing as I was growing up and getting more and more converts. It's much greater even now since I've left. Although the church in our village also is thriving and I think is quite big now in the south of Mali, it's much more difficult to talk about or understand people's religious motivations there, I think, than here, because some people, you know, would self-identify as Muslim but would definitely mix in traditional kinds of religion, and same with Christianity. But yeah, it's a growing and powerful movement throughout Mali and West Africa.
That's a really difficult place, particularly now. If you look up Mali, the first thing that comes to mind is that you can't travel there. There's a real strong warning that you ought not to go because of crime, kidnapping, terrorism, and the like. What was it like when you were growing up?
When I was growing up, it was wonderful. The Malian people are the most generous and kind and interesting and peaceful people. I think the country has become much more dangerous with the encroachment of Islam pushing down from the north and the, you know, weak governments. There's been many different coups over the years, and it's got to be more and more dangerous. I do know people, missionaries, who are there now and who are, I'm sure they're much more careful than we were when I was growing up. I mean, we never would lock our doors, and we, you know, walked around. We went everywhere we wanted to go. There was no kind of warnings when you traveled around the country. But yes, since I've left, and quite quickly, I think it's gotten to be more volatile and dangerous.
What was it like to grow up as a missionary's kid? How did that form you in what you're doing today?
Well, I loved being an MK. I loved living in Africa. It was very hard for me to even fathom coming back to America as a young person and then to find myself living here all these years later. I still am sometimes surprised. I do think it's, well, one thing, in very practical ways, I think growing up where I did was good for me because I learned how to cook and draw water out of a well, and I think I have a more integrated sense of what it means to live and be a person and a body and have to eat food and take care of the body than many of my peers, and certainly the generations that are coming up behind me. I had tons of pets. We rescued a lot of animals from hunters, and it was just a really wonderful place to grow up, and with a great deal of freedom to roam and ride around on my bike. And then even in boarding school, which I did find to be difficult, it was very Christian and a good place. I was formed really well as a Christian there. And given, of course, with the Baptists, I got a lot of biblical knowledge, which has stayed me through my adult years. I've been very grateful for all of the Bible that I got there, even before I encountered Christianity here. And I do think, if you can, growing up somewhere else and coming back to the States is a good way to do it, because you are going to be in culture shock one way or the other, and it's better if you just get it right out of the way.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Ann Kennedy. Should Christians make resolutions to be and do better, like vow to read more books, lose weight, or to help others? Well, it depends. Why are you resolving to do something? Is it because you want other people to notice your virtue, or do you want to glorify God? In making and fulfilling resolutions, one must discern whether the effort is an attempt to redeem oneself apart from the person and work of Christ. Be sure to read Ann Kennedy's article, "I'll Start My Diet Tomorrow, A Christian Makes a New Year's Resolution," in the current issue of the Christian Research Journal. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today, and in addition to receiving the print edition, you'll also have access to online exclusive articles. Call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Endless predictions about end-time events and published timetables counting down the end have proven to be wrong 100% of the time. When doomsday predictions fail, there is double-duty damage. Many theologically juvenile and scripturally superficial Christians abandon the faith as a result of these failed predictions, and the public image of Christianity is damaged, making Christians appear to be hopelessly naive and easily duped biblical bumpkins. Hank Hanegraaff's book, Prophetic Stars in the Constellation of Biblical Prophecy, will equip you not only to interpret biblical prophecy correctly, but to remember it as well. To receive your copy of Prophetic Stars as our thank you for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, or visit equip.org. Bertrand Russell famously said, "Most people would rather die than think, and many of them do." Not so with CRI support team members. Support team members are not only serious thinkers, but their membership in CRI's support team helps to equip hundreds of thousands of fellow believers around the globe each and every month. Are you not a member? Then you're missing out. Not only do support team members form the backbone of Christian Research Institute's outreaches, but they enjoy their selection of resources from our Equipping Essentials library and receive a complimentary subscription to CRI's award-winning Christian Research Journal, just two of the benefits of membership. To discover how you can make a difference 24/7 in equipping believers at home and abroad to stand for life and truth, check out the benefits of membership at equip.org. The Christian Research Journal is CRI's award-winning magazine, combining eye-catching design with well-researched articles to equip believers in doctrine, defense, and discernment. The Christian Research Journal's primary commitment is to contend earnestly for the faith that was once for all delivered to the saints. In keeping with this commitment, the journal's mission is both evangelistic and pastoral, furthering the proclamation and defense of the historic gospel of Jesus Christ, and helping his followers distinguish between essential Christian doctrine and doctrine that is peripheral, aberrant, or heretical. In an age of subjectivism and moral relativism, may Christians ground their faith and values in the objective, reliable testimony of Holy Scripture. Start your subscription to the Christian Research Journal today. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. let's rejoin Bible Answer Man host Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Ann Kennedy, in their conversation.
I'm real interested in your perspective on homeschooling. You have six children, as I mentioned in the introduction. We have 12 children. We adopted three of them. But both of us have large families. You have decided to homeschool, and I suppose a lot of people would be interested in your perspective on homeschooling because of what is happening in the educational system in America.
Well, I did it very reluctantly when we first moved here. I was not excited. I'm not a very good student myself, and I didn't read until very late, and I was pretty sure that I would not be able to do a good job. And I think in many ways that has definitely borne itself out. The catalog of my failures as a homeschooler is probably as long as a whole book of the Bible. But I do think God's providence was very large in our lives. The schools here were okay when we first moved here, but they weren't amazing. And the Catholic system was beyond our reach financially, and so we read some articles by Rod Dreher in Touchstone, and he convinced us that we really had no other choice. If we wanted to deliver up our children's souls to God, we were going to have to do it. So we just kind of leapt in and figured it out along the way. At one point, we tried to start a classical school here, but we didn't really have enough community buy-in, and it really didn't work, which was heartbreaking. But over the years, we've really muddled along, and now I have one child graduated, and another one is coming right up on her heels. He's going to graduate at the end of this academic year, and they are really nice Christian people, I'm discovering. And even though I was not a good, particularly good homeschooler, certainly not a very amazing mother, God filled in all the gaps, and I think they're going to be fine and probably do really interesting things for the kingdom of God. So I'm really grateful that it didn't kill me. I'm looking forward to it being done. I have a 10-year-old, so I still have another decade in front of me.
Reading your blogs and listening to you and reading your articles, I find you to be one of the most amazing people I've run into in a long time. You're writing a couple of articles for the Christian Research Journal. In other words, they're in the works right now. They haven't been published yet. I want you to talk a little bit about those articles. One is on the Revoice 2021 conference. What's that about?
Revoice is a movement that grew up in very recent times. I just finished listening to all the talks for this year, and I think it is, I can't remember if it's the third conference that they've done. It may be even the fourth. It was completely online, which is good because in the era of COVID, I think that's one of the blessings that's come about is that we've been able to see so many conferences have been put online, and so anybody can pay a little bit and watch them. So I was really grateful for that because I would never have been able to go to a conference like this. It grew up, I think, in the last few years as, you know, the noted shutting down of Exodus International, and I think a sense that the way that evangelicals had thought about homosexuality was becoming archaic and no longer really acceptable, and a growing movement in the church that it is appropriate and good to identify as gay or queer, and because that's so, a sense of spiritual homelessness in churches where people are not excited about that designation. So that's the idea behind the conference, and I'm in a group right now where there are members of Revoice and people on the board. I've watched it over the past few years with real anxiety, having, you know, in very recent times left the Episcopal Church over this very issue. I have been anxious about this movement and what it represents. So I listened to the whole conference, and I'm glad that I did that yesterday. I just finished listening, so I'm able to say a little bit. I think that in some ways I have deep sympathy with the movement and the people who spoke and the pain that many people feel. This culture that we're in is, this is one of the primary ways that people identify themselves, is by their sexuality. It's the main identifying marker of personhood. And so for the church to come along and say, well, we don't want you to do that. We want you to identify as a Christian first and as everything else second, is a very painful thing for people to hear. And that came up over and over and over again in the talks. So I feel very sympathetic. I feel theologically that they are treading on really thin ice, because I think that the scripture is very clear about personhood and sexuality, and that who we are in Christ comes before anything else. And I also, it seems to me that the movement is sort of solidifying in the way that they're thinking about sexuality to such a degree that it will end up dividing away from more orthodox and traditional ways of being Christian in America.
I'm looking forward to reading the article when it comes out. Also, you're working on an article on manifesting, which seems to be like the secret 2.0. This is a very, very interesting subject to me. I've written on this subject myself, written about Rhonda Byrne and The Secret, where she talks about the secret being the most powerful law in the universe, that you create your life through your thoughts. It seems like a takeoff on steroids from the prosperity gospel in some ways.
It really does. It's a word of faith idea that if you can control your thoughts and your feelings as a way of controlling your thoughts, then you can bring things into being, essentially, or you can at least align yourself with the frequencies of the universe to such a degree that you will get whatever you want, which, you know, is very tempting, except when you realize that you're probably not doing a good job. You probably still don't have the things that you want. It really seems, as I researched it, to be a very cruel message, a cruel way of conceiving of the universe, because most people are not getting what they want. Most people aren't Jennifer Aniston, for example, who feels like she manifested friends. Most people aren't Jim Carrey either. He wrote a check to himself for $1 million or more, and, you know, at the end of the year, he was able to cash the check. And so he feels like he just brought that forth by visualizing it. Most people don't succeed in doing that. It feels to me like the prosperity gospel, the word of faith heresy, but it has overlap even with the way that people in an African traditional religion would consider the spiritual realm, that not so much that the universe would give you what you want, but the spirit realm would hear you and hear your thoughts and would give you something, whether for good or for ill. And so it is very important that you control your mind and you don't give way to certain kinds of thinking, because, for instance, the jinns might hear you, but they wouldn't know whether you wanted it or not, and so they might give you something that you're afraid of, which is also there in The Secret. It's a fascinating, fascinating religious idea.
And dangerous, as you point out. In the upcoming issue of the Christian Research Journal, you have an article which is titled, I'll Start My Diet Tomorrow, A Christian Makes a New Year's Resolution. What I found fascinating in reading that article is your commitment to the value of reading. This is something that I have talked about, written about in various forums. I've often quoted C.S. Lewis, who immersed himself in the classics. He treasured them. And he often advised people that they ought to augment the reading of every new book with one that has withstood the test of time. In other words, to read the classics over and over again until you own the content of the classics. In fact, here's a quote which I've thought of for a long time because it's so poignant and profound. Lewis said, an unliterary person may be defined as a person who reads books only once. So Lewis was saying, read the classics and own their content. Don't just read them once, read them again and again. I bring this up in the context of doing this podcast with you, Ann, because you made a commitment to reading, which is pretty stunning. And I'd like you to elaborate on that, because so many people in our culture have given up on reading.
I have always loved to read. I adore reading. I found that as I gave birth to one child and then another one, that my reading life disappeared. I remember starting to read the Pickwick Papers when I was in labor with my fourth child, and I didn't finish it until she was 5 years old. And I'm also pretty sure that I didn't read anything else in those intervening years. And I started to feel grief and sort of a hollow feeling inside.
We'll have to stop here for today's edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Ann Kennedy. To read Ann Kennedy's print and online exclusive articles, subscribe to the Christian Research Journal when you call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write CRI, Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters and life matters more.
With the new atheists increasing their mockery of Christianity and militant secularism ridiculing religious convictions of all stripes, we clearly don't need zealous but misguided Christians inviting further abuse by misreading and misrepresenting biblical prophecies. Hank Hanegraaff's book, Prophetic Stars in the Constellation of Biblical Prophecy, will enable you to understand, remember, and communicate biblical prophecy. Moreover, your investment in Prophetic Stars through the Christian Research Institute will equip and encourage eager Christian brothers and sisters who genuinely yearn for truth and reliable tools to apprehend and defend their faith. To receive your copy of Prophetic Stars as our thank you for your gift, simply call 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org.